50 years ago, Kansas soldiers joined 2 million Americans who fought in the Vietnam War. I'm Kay McIntyre, today on KPR Presents Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War, an oral history project sponsored by Humanities Kansas. KPR is one of 12 organizations across the state that collected the stories of Vietnam veterans for this project. Their stories will be archived at the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. We'll meet our vets in just a minute, but first, did you serve in Vietnam? Did your brother or dad or other family member? Did you wear a POW bracelet or remember watching the war unfold on the nightly news? What do you remember about the war? Join in the conversation right now on KPR's Facebook page. Now, let's hear from some of the Kansans who served in Vietnam.
My name is Kenneth J. Baldwin. I served in the Army, active duty from October of 1966 to October of 1968 during the Vietnam conflict.
My name is Stanley Rowe, R-O-W-E.
My name is Bob Dick.
My name is David Han.
David A., that's for Allen. Deneen, D-I-N-N-E-E-N.
My name is Don Willoughby. I live in Sioux City, Iowa. However, I was raised at Hutchinson, Kansas, graduated from the University of Kansas, and graduated from KU's ROTC program.
My name is David L. Tangman, U.S. 564-321-90, sir. Basic training, you met the bus at the county seat, which was Seneca, Kansas, county seat of Nemaha County. My dad drove me there. My mom didn't go along, and it's one of those things that sticks in your mind, and probably 10, 15, 20 years later, I asked my mom why she hadn't gone along, and she had an answer. She said, I watched my mother send my brothers to war, World War II, and I just couldn't do it. But it took me all those years to be able to ask that. So the bus then drove you down and wound up at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, for basic training. And basic training is what? Strip you of your identity. I mean, you're stripped naked, your hair is shaved off, and suddenly you're U.S. 564-321-90.
We got down to Fort Leonard Wood in the middle of the night. We pull into a company area, and they put all these lights on. They hustle you off the bus, and you don't really know what's going on. And the sergeants all start yelling at you. And the first thing they're doing is yelling at you, you know, fall in, get in ranks, dress right, dress, the whole nine yards. There were three of us together, Lonnie LeBombard, Jim Bost, and myself, who all went through school together, all the way through high school, graduated together. And we had a gym teacher in Central Junior High called Mr. Duver. Mr. Duver was ex-military, and he taught you how to fall in ranks and dress right, dress. When we got off the bus and they started hollering at us, Jim and Lonnie and I were all right next to each other. We fell in. We did dress right dress. And I remember the sergeant looking at us and hollering at all these people, like these guys right here. And I'm standing there thinking, thank you, Mr. Duver.
You did him proud.
He did us good.
The first thing they do is they cut your hair, make you stand on a cup on some yellow footprints, which is, to this day, that made me realize I was in the Marine Corps, and that's the only time in my life that I've ever been afraid. And it wasn't afraid of the Corps, it was afraid that I would let the Corps down.
They strip away who you are and make you someone else. So you come in at night, you're lost, you're disoriented, you have large men yelling at you. The first day you lose your curly locks, and all the while you're harassed, and the goal is to make everyone tough, mentally tough, and learn what you can do. I used to joke that if my swim coaches in high school and college had been able to get enough out of me as my drill sergeant did, then I would have been a better swimmer. because I always had too much left in the tank at the end of the race. The Army taught me I always had more.
So as soon as you stand on those yellow footprints, you know your life is changed irrevocably. We had 4 weeks of, you might call breaking in training or whatever, where we learned the ropes in far as, so far as always standing at attention when you spoke, always asking permission to speak, never sitting down, and never walk, always, as they say, double timing, usually is the case. You learn to march. The first thing in marching that got me was what is known as the drill instructor's cadence. And instead of going 1, 2, 3, they go, or left, right, left, they go lail, right, lail. And they each have a distinctive cadence of their own, some to different melodies and some. So they all pride themselves on their cadence. And as a recruit, you must recognize your drill instructor's cadence so you do not get confused by another drill instructor's commands, for example, to left flank left or whatever the whatever it's going to be. And because if you do, you're going to be in a world of trouble, of course.
When I went into the Marine Corps in January of 65, I was 5 foot nine and 210 pounds. I was a roly-poly little devil. When I went home after that, I was 5'11 and 160 pounds. I had no hair. I had no fat. And it was all muscle. And the folks didn't know me when I came home.
I was at Fort Dix in the wintertime. Fort Dix gets very cold, very cold. And we were doing grenade training. You pull a pin and hold it for a certain amount of time and then release it. We were not allowed to have gloves. You would ordinarily have gloves. But no, while you're in training, you know, you got to learn how to be tough. My hands stuck to the grenade. I couldn't throw it. I couldn't release it to throw it. But if I opened up my hand a little bit, it would start ticking. And that's the time. And that was the kind of grenade it was. You pulled the pin, and you released, and then you threw. And I couldn't do anything with it. And finally, a sergeant saw what was going on. He just pulled it. I mean, I think it ripped some skin, actually. It was that, you know, how you put your tongue on a cold metal bar or something like that.
Before I left, I got orders to go to the Pacific Air Force Jungle Survival School at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, which was a one-week school where they taught you bugs to eat and how to get rainwater out of the water tree and don't eat monkey bananas, but these kind of bananas. And then they also taught us things like the miner's code that our prisoners of war were using in the Hanoi Hilton and those things. And then they put us out in the jungle, and we had to survive for a day and a night living in the jungle. And they had the little hill negritos searching for us, which if they found us, then they got 10 pounds of rice. So there was an incentive for them, and most people got captured. And the bottom line was the whole thing. If you get shot down up north, you can try to escape and evade as much as you want. However, the locals from that area, they know every inch of the land, and you will be caught.
That's Don Willoughby, David Dineen, Stan Rao, David Han, Bob Dick, Ken Baldwin, and David Tangman. 7 of the 12 veterans I had the privilege to interview as part of the Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War. It's an oral history project sponsored by Humanities Kansas as part of the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. Did you serve in Vietnam? Did a loved one? What do you remember about the Vietnam War? Share your memories on Kansas Public Radio's Facebook page. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Let's meet the rest of our veterans.
Hello, my name is Bob Harvey. I entered as an enlisted individual in the United States Army Security Agency in September of 1967 and left active duty in June of 1971.
My name is Robert Onick, And my Vietnam experience was branch of service was the Army with an AG branch assignment.
My name is David Darwin. I served as a captain in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers from January 10th to December 25th during the Vietnam conflict.
My name is H.C. Palmer. I live in Lenexa, Kansas. I was finishing my first year of residency at the University of Kansas Medical Center in internal medicine. In April, I received my draft notice and found out from some of the people at the medical school that actually 1,500 doctors had been drafted at the time.
And my name is John Solbach. I entered the United States Marine Corps as a private in April of 1966, and I had the rank of Sergeant E5 when I left in late July of 1969.
The first impression was you got sweat pores over every portion of your body when the plane opened, and I know that they put us all on a bus, and the bus driver, I'm sure, quite deliberately took us through the village, and you're looking out at a world that is totally alien and foreign to anything you ever grew up with. And, you know, the old cliche, it ain't Kansas, Toto.
You set foot on this country that is so has been so devastated for so long. You see all these men walking around with guns. You'd had to train with them, but you'd not send that many men with guns at any one given time.
First thing I remember about Vietnam is we went over and we landed at Tonson Nut Air Base, got off the jet, and the heat and humidity hit you. They put us on a bus to take us to the replacement center. One of my memory, or my most vivid memory of that is, as we're driving through villages, towns, or, you know, the community, I looked out and I saw people, all kinds of people. But all our training and through basic, NAIT, and everything, says, you know, the Viet Cong wear black pajamas. The Viet Cong wear black pajamas. We're driving through all this community, and everybody had on black pajamas. And my first thought was, okay, throw that one out the window, because that's not going to work. That was my first impression of Vietnam.
We got on buses. There were really heavy screens on the windows. I mean, not screens, but wire mesh. And we all knew what that was for. Because in previous years before, VC had thrown hand grenades in these, and so this would make them bounce off.
We actually first landed at Chu Lai, an amphibious landing. It looks like going over the side, just like in the movies. And we stayed there one night, and then some of us stayed at Chu Lai, some of us went on farther north, which we did. We went up to Da Nang, and we did another amphibious landing, although not in the mic boats. It was on what I think maybe called a landing ship dock, LSD, where it had a huge ramp that went down, and because they could get larger equipment on the base and stuff. So then we proceeded to the Da Nang Electronic Maintenance Company. It was a 3rd Force Service Regiment. When we first got there, we were assembled, and the commanding officer said, the uniform of the day is rolled up sleeves. Roll up our sleeves. This was in March. You could immediately feel our skin burning. You know, it was hot, of course, as it would be. And being in the Marine Corps, you're first a rifleman, which means if they have anything to do, guard work or whatever, they're going to tap you no matter what your MOS is. And so I was every now and then I was put road guard on trucks. And the first time I got in, the driver says, take your flak jacket off and put it on the floor. We're not likely to get ambushed during the day anyway. But if we hit a mine, that'll help save your legs maybe.
When you're first in country, you don't know the difference in sound between, and you're in the artillery around howitzers. Every explosion makes you jump until you become used to the outgoing rounds, and then it's just like a train going by every 4 hours on the main line. You don't even think about it. That's an outgoing round. So the new guys, the FNGs as they were called, were
jumpy with each outgoing round. Then when an incoming round came in, that's when you needed to take cover. And of course you didn't hear it before the first explosion. So I don't remember the first incoming round. Certainly would have been in Tainan City. I do remember probably the closest call I had was in Tainan City. The Filipino Hooches, they had sandbag sides, sandbag roofs, three layers of sandbags on the roof, and what supported that weight were these pieces of PSP linked together, the PSP that they use for airstrips. And the hooch next to mine, it must have been sometime between 10 o'clock and midnight, the next door hooch took a direct hit from a 122 rocket. Fortunately, it did not have a time delay fuse. That is, as soon as it hit the first sandbag, it exploded. And also, fortunately, it hit direct center, which meant that in addition to the sandbags and the PSP, it had to go through probably a 4 by 12 inch wood beam supporting the PSP through the center of the building. If it hadn't hit there, it would have gone on in and probably killed the occupants. As it were, it broke that 4 by 12 inch beam and fell onto the leg of one of the sleeping troops there. It broke his leg, but he was definitely a survivor. And that was a 122 rocket. It stands about 5-6 feet tall. That was the biggest rocket, the biggest piece of artillery that was generally in the hands of the enemy.
The first night we were there, some VC, I suppose, Viet Cong, shot a couple times from somewhere, probably an AR or an AK-47. And when those shots went off, the whole perimeter started shooting out. There would have been 50 caliber, 30 caliber M60 machine guns, M16s, and some M14s as well. And it was the loudest noise I'd ever heard in my life, and I was in the middle. I don't know how you could stand it out on the perimeter, but that was probably end of the second or third week in country. And I thought, man, I have never been, I wasn't being shot at. And I said, this is scary stuff, man. I want to put my head under the ground. I've never heard anything like it. That was enough to scare the heck out of me.
We weren't actually taking the fight to the enemy. We were building roads. And so the enemy would occasionally bring the fight to us. But during the time I was with the 589th, nobody shot at me. Actually, the whole time I was in Vietnam, we were out in the middle of the country if the VC wanted to kill us, they could have, because we were just soldiers out there. We were engineer soldiers, and we didn't have armor or artillery or anything like that to back us up. In general, engineers' morale was very high. Certainly high compared to infantry or artillery or armor, where you had to go face to face with the enemy. I think the VC over somewhere, they said, well, these guys are building roads for us. Let them just build. Let's harass them a little bit, but let them build roads, because maybe somebody thought they were going to take over these roads. And by the way, I had battalion members go back in the 1990s, so this is 25, 26 years later, and the roads are still there. They were doing good then. I don't know how they're doing now, but the roads were still quite serviceable, the ones we had put in.
The young men that I worked with did a job and did it well. We were one of five battalions scattered along QL4, which is a national highways like US 75 is. And we had five battalions scattered along that road. Each one of them had a segment to build that road. Now, did we have problems building the road? No, because those friendly guys called Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, they liked the road because they could use it. But they did let us know that they were there. They would dig holes in the road, put rice plants on them. Now, there might be explosive in those holes or maybe be nothing. So what we would do, instead of going out trying to hurt any of our kids, we would just blow the road, rebuild it, and just keep going. Then the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese go downtown to the local population. Say, see, that U.S. Army is dumb. They don't know what to do.
I was in charge of the translator pool. And we had about 20 Vietnamese, South and Central Vietnamese, who worked there, all of whom spoke at least one dialect of Vietnamese and French and English, a little bit of English. Their English was not great, except for a few of them. I should say that most of the Vietnamese army officers had gone to Saint-Cyr in France, actually near where I later lived in Brittany. And they spoke French by preference on military matters. They didn't have the words in Vietnamese for many military things. Most of the words that ultimately got into Vietnamese on military matters were translated from Chinese, not from English, but from Chinese, and then they went back and forth. So the point is that the people that worked in my office were working from Vietnamese to French to English, and so they would have problems in their English, and they could explain to me in French what their problems were. So they were learning more English in a way from me through French, and they were getting their translations done. And I have, you know, I was anti-military, but I had an awful lot of respect for the officers that I met at MAG Vietnam, because that was a Military Assistance Advisory Group, Vietnam, MMAG. And MAG Vietnam was a well-run program with Hanging Sam Williams was the general in charge. He was the Hanging Sam Williams from the Nuremberg trials. So that's what I was doing. I was mainly doing translating work and working with the Vietnamese.
So when I went to the field, I was an infantryman, 11 Bravo, their terms grunt, cannon fodder. And for that time then, you're assigned to a squad, 1-6 Mike Indy. I was in the first squad, whatever, and carried the rifle, and you did the things that you're assigned to do, which is at some point you walk point, at some point you walk flank, at some point you walk drag, you chop through jungle with a machete, you walk through rice paddies with a as your boots come out of the mud. And then at some point in there, I carried the M79, which is basically like a sawed-off shotgun. And later, in those 3 months I was in the field, I carried a radio, the PR-25, which adds extra pounds to your weight that you're carrying. And it has an antenna that sticks straight up, and it's like, okay, you're no fool. So you bend the antenna, and then you take a plastic spoon so it's sticking out right in front of you. Because the classic is, okay, if the VC or whatever are intent and clever and intelligent, which they are, they are going to shoot the guy in front or behind the radio and then the radio. So take care.
I was sent to the first CAV, which was their base camp was in Anh Ke. And so I got sent up there and spent about a week at base camp going through orientation, a little more training, and I got sent to a company in the field. They wanted some people to do long-range patrols, which was not a fun thing to do, okay? It had some inherent dangers with it. So me and another guy, Marvin, who was my best friend there, we went to the field together. I'd never met him before, but anyway, we got thrown in together because we were the new guys. We had to go do the long-range patrols. That's where they essentially clear everybody out of an area. I don't know how big it would be, depending on what they wanted. And they would insert a patrol in there, and you would patrol around, and your duty was to record and transmit any information on enemy movements and things like that there. And the way we did it, the group I was with, was we would patrol through an area, and we'd say, okay, this is where we're going to spend the night. But we wouldn't stop there. We would go on a ways, stop till right about dusk, and then go back to the area where we wanted to be, and we'd set up our perimeter. We'd set out booby traps, trip flares, whole nine yards, and we would have to do at night what we call sit reps, which is situation reports. We have a radio with us, and you sit there and you have the squelch turned down real low to where you can barely hear it, and you have to have it up to your ear the whole time. And you would get a call in, give your call sign, which would be Ranger 4, sit rep. And what you didn't ever talk. All you did was break squelch once for good or twice for we're in trouble. And every night when you set up your perimeters, we would have a fallback position where if we got hit, this is where we're going to be to. This is where we're going back to, and this is where we're going to be. This is where we're going to meet up at. So every night I would always lay down with my feet pointing north so I know which direction, if I woke up in the middle of the night, which was north, south, which way I had to go. You put your stuff in the same place every night. Now, on long-range patrols, we didn't dig holes, and we didn't set up. We slept on the ground. We didn't any cover or anything. So you put the same, everything in the same place every night so you'd remember it. Well, Marvin had did this, and in the middle of the night or sometime during the evening, one of the trip flares went off and one of the booby traps went off. The first thing Marvin did was grab his helmet and throw it on his head. And then he started grabbed his head and he started moaning. And I'm going, Marvin, you okay? Marvin, you okay? Marvin, oh, my head. And I looked down, and he had put his grenades in his helmet. And then when he put his helmet on, those grenades hit his head. And you dumb s***. And that was just one of the things that sticks in my mind, about that. It was just a good memory.
What I enjoyed over there and felt like at some point when I figured out that we were the enemy in Vietnam, we did a lot of what we call MedCap work, medical civil action patrols. And we went out to little villages and treated people for this and that. And mostly kids with bad skin infections and so forth. But we delivered a baby or two. But that was rewarding because we went out there and did that. And I know we treated some VC out there because they would come in with wounds that were compatible with shrapnel or something like that. And I asked my CO, I said, what do we do with these guys we think are VC? And he said, Doc, you do what you want to with them, what your conscience will let you do. So we just treat them, let them go. And a lot of people wouldn't agree with that because they're going to be back shooting at us again. But, hey, we were in their city, in their town, in their country. And I figured that if we're going to do some good, let's do some good.
H.C. Palmer, Ken Baldwin, David Tangman, and David Dineen. Four of the veterans in KPR's Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War. It's a statewide oral history project sponsored by Humanities Kansas in partnership with the David Woods Kemper Veterans Foundation, the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, and the Veterans Voices Writing Project. I'm Kay McIntyre. Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War will continue right after this. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we are 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org, where you can find more interview excerpts and photos from KPR's Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War project. If you have memories of the Vietnam War that you'd like to share, go to KPR's Facebook page.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, presenting a Canadian Brass Christmas featuring festive classics of the season and favorite brass standards. Sunday, December 9th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu.
Today on KPR Presents, Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War, an oral history project sponsored by Humanities Kansas. To mark the 50th anniversary of America's escalating involvement in Vietnam, 12 organizations across the state collected oral histories of Kansans who served. We invite you to share your own memories of the Vietnam War at KPR's Facebook page. And now, Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War continues with John Solbach, Don Willoughby, David Tangman, and David Darwin.
I do remember walking through a village early when I was there. Beautiful village in northern Quang Tri province. The captain had us stop at a river and made us all wash our clothes and take baths so we could make a good impression when we went through the village. And we marched through the village. There was a French priest that stood outside the church. He was bowing to us. There were Vietnamese out in the fields tending to the rice crop. There were women in the orchard picking citrus and other things that grew in the orchard. There were nuns who were herding the children into the church. They were singing in Latin Ave Maria, a song that I sang when I was a boy in church. And I thought, you know, this is why we're here, to protect people like this. And we marched on through that village. The next time we went through the village, the church had been totally bombed out, and you could read on the altar, said Ave Maria, but the church was gone. The altar was still there. The well had been caved in. There were napalm casings where the rice paddies had been. The trees were all split up in the orchard. The village had been abandoned. I thought to myself, we didn't do a very good job of protecting that particular village.
It can be good days for a lot of you had a good mission. You were successful. You saw bad guys. They were taken out. You escorted Miss America around the area. I was able to scrounge up, you know, 5 window air conditioners from another unit, you know, and trades and that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just, it all depends. I mean, it's just a variety of things that created a good day. A lot of it was just the camaraderie of the guys, because you were all going through the same thing that you were. And if everybody came back, that was a good day, you know, even though planes may have gotten shot and everything else, but everybody was back. So, yeah, that was a good day then.
Holidays were miserable. It's the worst and loneliest time. The first Christmas, I was in the field and felt fortunate that our platoon didn't have patrol on Christmas Day. And it's always, and they sent out some cooks who were terrified with their little hot containers of hot food, whatever, which was actually pretty terrible. And then the second Christmas, I was in the rear, and there's two stories involved with that. We got care packages from home, and instead of eating them, we saved them and combined them for a Christmas dinner, which was all, I guess you could call it potluck out of a can. And it's one of the best meals, family or Christmas meals in a family of necessity that I had. And the other thing was my oldest sis, Jane, is an excellent gift giver. So she sends me one of those little Christmas trees, little fake Christmas trees, oh, probably about 2 feet tall maybe. And then she took pictures of everybody in the family and cut out the head, and she made a little egg-shaped frame and a string to hang on the tree with a note, since you can't be with us this Christmas, brother. Since you can't be with us this Christmas, brother, we will be with you. And in my life, it is the best and the most considerate, thoughtful, loving present I think I have ever received and probably will ever receive.
We were probably 15 miles from the battalion, and it was getting late, and we had we were on a road coming back up, and there was a roadblock there. And this is one of the least smart things I did in my life. I went to move the roadblock, and it was booby-trapped. It was booby-trapped by the by the Vietnamese army, and we had been moving roadblocks, my driver and I, all over the place around the airfield, and so at any rate, it detonated a hand grenade. And at that point, I don't remember much at all because I went into shock immediately. My driver remembered things. And I woke up in the Air Force Convalescent Hospital. And I can't say, I mean, I was really stupid on my part, but that was the end of my command of that company. And they said, well, this is a really important company, and we can't wait for you to get out of the hospital, and we don't know how long you're going to be in the hospital. And so we're going to assign it to another captain who is just coming in. And so I was actually, at the time, though, I was upset that I had lost my command. It turns out that I was in the hospital only for a week, and I was back on duty.
September 12th, 1968. We were attacked, a mortar attack and a rocket attack. And we scattered, and I dove next to a wall, and one of my associates, I don't want to call him a friend, we knew each other, dove on top of me. Another person dove down as well. A mortar round hit within 10 yards of us or so. And the fellow was on top of me. Well, once that was done, I got slammed against the wall, and I dragged him into the club and looked, and he had been wounded in the lung. And I did smoke back then, heaven forbid, but I did. Thank goodness, because I was able to seal his lung wound with the cellophane that came from a pack of cigarettes and held it there until the medics finally came. And then I left and never saw him again because I had to run and get down to the line. It was interesting back in when Facebook first came out, some mid 2000, 2005, 4, whatever it is, got a post from, because his nickname was Fuzzy, and I had forgotten what his name was. And the question was written, does anybody remember September the 12th, 1968? And so I typed back in, yeah, you know, I can remember Fuzzy. And he typed back, I'm Fuzzy. That was one of the most memorable days of September the 12th.
You saved his life.
How would one know? There was a lot of things going on.
There was a guy, a little infantry guy, probably 5, 6, or 7, that came walking one morning after there was some fire on the perimeter, came walking in and had a scratch on the top of his head, and he was carrying his helmet with a bullet hole in it. So came in the front and went out the top. So, you know, that was a pretty interesting patient. And all he took was a little Neosporin ointment and sent him back out, new helmet, and sent him back.
That's one lucky guy.
One lucky guy, yeah.
I thought that I had been killed, and if my face had been 2 inches further to the west or further to the east, I would have been. But I caught a small piece of shrapnel about the size of a rifle bullet that embedded in my skull, and I didn't lose consciousness. I went to the ground. When I hit the ground, I could still hear those rounds coming in. I could smell the TNT, burning TNT, and I could hear people running and screaming. I dug a hole in the ground about half the size of this desk and about as deep as it is high. And then I crawled into it, and a corpsman got in with me. Another person leaned over the side with a flashlight. They put a poncho over the top so the light could escape. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't know if anyone could see us or not. And he cut the shrapnel out of my head with a razor blade that he sterilized with a C-ration match.
Right there in the hole.
It's the only place you could do it.
I had just gotten back with the company from LRPs, and we were, I'm not sure exactly where we were coming from, but we were going down onto the Bonesong Plain. That morning, our platoon had point, our squad had point, And one of the point men was, or the guy who was assigned to do point, was getting ready to go on R&R. And he was going to leave the next morning. And he was a little bit perturbed about the fact that he had to walk point that morning, you know, before he could leave to go on R&R. So I said, hey, you know, no problem, I'll walk point for you. So we started out. And we're going down a rather steep incline. I was walking point. And come around a corner in the trail, you know, being real careful, looking for stuff. And if you're on a steep incline, there's times when you don't have both feet on the ground. You know, you have one up, and before you set it down, the other one comes up. Well, right about that time, I saw the tripwire. I couldn't stop. So when I hit it, I hollered, turned around, and started back up the hill. And grenade went off, and I got hit. So I jumped over in the bushes and laid there and kind of did a check and think, oh, you know, I'm still only one piece. You know, I really don't feel anything because I think shock was setting and I didn't really have any pain. After everything quieted down, somebody hollered out, hey, is anybody hit? I hollered back, yes. And they said, who? I said, me. You know, how bad is it? I don't know. Can you walk? I haven't tried. So when they cleared the area, they came down and picked me up and medevaced me out. And I had surgery and stuff, and they sent me to Okinawa for about 2 or 3 weeks for recovery. And then I got well and got sent back. When I got sent to Okinawa, and I'm laying in bed, and they come by in, and well, we got to clean your wounds. Okay, fine. And it's Q-tips and hydrogen peroxide. Well, I had bandages on several parts of my body, and they were cleaning all these. And when I seen what they were doing, there was one part where my body that, no. Forrest Gump and I had something in common. I got it in the right, left buttock. And they said, okay, did we get them all? And I said, yep, you got them all. I'm going to take care of the other part. I was not going to roll over,
We had a horrible, horrible trip coming back from Vietnam. We got on the plane, and as the plane was taking off, I noticed, I was looking out, the gasoline was spewing from the gas tanks on the side. And the stewards, the guys that were in the back, ran up to the front. So my brother, when I told him, he was a weights and balance officer in the Air Force all through World War II. I told him, and he said, David, no, you're not here. That plane would have caught on fire, and that would have been it. Somehow it didn't. And then they got up, and they had to jettison all the fuel and come back and land again. So we spent 3 days in Kwajalein. And every place we went, there was a problem. We finally went from Hawaii to home. And when we arrived home, back in Oakland Air Force Base and got off the plane, that was the best day in the Army. Yeah, that was the best day.
They flew us into El Toro Marine Air Station just outside of L.A. Then they put us on buses that had blacked out windows. It was at night, because there were people who didn't like us being there, you know. And so I had a few hours for my plane to leave to go to Kansas City. And I was sitting in we call them slop chutes, a little hamburger joint there in the airport. And I looked out of the little restaurant there, and there was a person, and this person had the most beautiful long blonde hair. And as I was sitting there contemplating this, it turns around and has a beard down to its belly, and it's a guy. And I said, oh my God, I've gone off the deep end. That was my return to the States. They weren't like that when I left that much. you know. And that was just 13 months, and things had changed so drastically in that 13 months. I came home. I didn't tell anybody I was coming. So I got back to Topeka, and it took me a while to find my father because he had moved and hadn't told me he was going to do it. Or he had, and hadn't crossed paths. But I finally found my dad, and then a couple days later, I went to see my mother. So I stopped and rang the doorbell, and she came to the door, and she says, "May I help you?" She didn't know who I was, because I was very skinny, and the last time she'd seen me, I was a pudgy. And I said, "Well, Mom, how are you?" And then she recognized me by my voice. So I went in and I sat down and talked to Mom for a while. And then my little sister came home. And I went in and sat on the couch in the living room with her. And she didn't take any time at all. And she said, and she was a freshman at Washburn. And she asked me what I thought of the Vietnam War. I said, "Well, Kathy, that is a very important thing that we're doing there. Those people really, really needed us there." And she said to me, "Well, you're just like the rest of those baby killers." So I got up off the couch, walked out the door, and I didn't speak to my sister for 30 years.
I didn't like getting spit on. Did I? Yes. And then they would put the National Guard units back together, take their convoys down the road to go to the training site, and you have civilian cars trying to push National Guard trucks off the side of the road, actually run them over. So, yes, did we have problems? Yes, we had problems. But like I said, we had great kids, and those guys stayed with it, and we got the job done.
When the Vietnam Memorial Wall opened in Washington, D.C., my parents went when it first opened because they were living in New Jersey, not too terribly far. And the wall, the names on the wall, the casualties are listed in a chronological order, but they also have an alpha directory. And my mother likened it to getting the old phone book, looking up your phone number. So she went to the alpha directory and she opened it and saw Harvey Robert George. And that's my full name. And she just about collapsed. So the Robert G. Harvey that's on the wall, he was from Washington, Iowa. He was a Marine, was killed August the 10th of 1968. And so I got a, I don't call it, a hero's bracelet after that with his name on it. And I wear it every day. It's, I may need to paint it because all the black is coming off it after so many years. What it brought back to me is what parents went through when their kids at 19 and 20 are halfway across the world. And so I'm a lot more thankful for the parents than for those who also suffered through Vietnam.
A lot came home when you went back in, took a look at the register, and you found your old buddies. Had a close friend from McPherson. He was, of all things, when he went over, he was assigned as a PX officer. Then he suddenly showed up on the killed in action. How in the world did a PX officer get killed in action? Well, he got transferred over to a unit as an advisor, and both he and his civilian, his military advisor, were both killed in a raid. There are 40 plus of our 69th Brigade members that didn't come back. And yes, I could find them on that wall.
Two of my children are special needs. My son, who is going to be 41 next month, is deaf, and he was six, maybe seven, something like that. And I went to the wall and I looked on panel 49 West, line 40. And that's where Robert G. Harvey is listed. And I started crying. And my son looked at my wife. Vocally, my wife said, he's saying, "Why is Daddy crying? Why Daddy cry?" I've been there two or three times. Something magical about it.
We were at the wall, and it was, it was probably 10 degrees. There weren't 20 people at the wall. And usually it's packed. And I wrote this after we came home. Last winter, at the wall again, snowing and very cold, it seemed we were alone until a man and a woman reflected in the granite from behind us. For a long time, I watched them inside the stone. When I turned, I saw them weeping. "Do you have someone here?" I asked. "Just the two of you," she said.
The first time I went with my cousin's kid, Eric Felkamp. I told him if I had a kid, I'd want him to be you. He's just a lovely man. He was 19 years old, and at that time I was in my 40s. The statistical age of the draftee, of the soldier in Vietnam, was 19 years old. I know men on that wall. I know several men on that wall. And there's a difference between weeping and crying and being racked with grief. And startling my cousin's kid, Eric, all of a sudden I am racked with grief and an awareness that I had never in my wildest imagination thought ever that I wished I had died in Vietnam and that my name would be on that wall so that my name would be with buddies and friends forever and ever.
What would you like people to know about your military service?
Well, nobody's ever asked me that. Well, first of all, I'd like them to know that I served and that I did my duty, my job, that I'm glad I got to do some work with civilians. I'm glad that at some point, 40 years after, I started writing about it, because it's been healing for me, although I didn't have any horrific things happen to me personally. And I'd like them to know that other writers like myself that write about war, usually almost all the ones I know are very anti-war, and they understand that wars are caused by people in government, and that basically when you're out there in a war, you're just killing somebody just like yourself.
The war in Vietnam, the United States Army, in combination with the Navy and the Air Force, I believe never lost a battle. But we lost the war. The war was political. It was a domino theory. And I understand the logic. You know, people discussing now, oh, well, that was bad logic. All, you know, we're talking a long time ago. The domino theory was valid. And it still is kind of valid. I guess my case, I was confused that I knew what I was doing every day of the week. I knew what mission I had. And I could do that, but I didn't know what the overall mission was of why we were doing it.
I did my duty. I was a Marine. I served with some very phenomenal people. They kept me alive.
You kept them alive?
Sometimes.
Those of us who we're willing to subject ourselves to so much
that other people will never have to. Did it because it was an honor to do it. Not because we had to, but because it was an honor to do it. In my day, there was a draft. So some of us didn't do it voluntarily. But today, it's all volunteer. So I just led the way for those that are there today. But they did it, much like I did, because it was something that I felt needed to be done. I didn't do it because I wanted to go out into the world and blow a bunch of people up. There were people out there that wanted to do that, that I wanted to stop. And even though our government let us down in 1972, we saved a lot of people. We did a lot of good.
It was a privilege. I would do it again in a heartbeat. Because over the years, I truly believe that we were helping the people of Vietnam. Not the government. Governments are corrupt. Everybody's government is. But the people. I've met so many wonderful people, from Vietnamese people that have been able to come here. As the years went by, I realized that's who I was doing this for. Knowing what we were trying to do to help them, we won that.
You've been listening to Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War, a statewide oral history project marking the 50th anniversary of America's escalating involvement in the Vietnam War. A special thanks to the Kansas veterans who shared their stories: Ken Baldwin, David Darwin, Bob Dick, David Dineen, David Han, Bob Harvey, Bob Onick, H.C. Palmer, Stan Rao, John Solbach, David Tangman, and Don Willoughby. A very special thanks to John Musgrave. Not only was he instrumental in recruiting fellow Vietnam vets, my interview with him last year was the first step in my involvement with this project. You can hear that interview on our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Today's KPR Presents features only a fraction of these veteran stories. Go to our website for more interview excerpts as well as photographs. Kansas Public Radio invites you to share your own memories of the Vietnam War at KPR's Facebook page. A final thank you to Humanities Kansas and Merle Riedel for their help with Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War. This project has been sponsored by Humanities Kansas in partnership with the David Woods Kemper Veterans Foundation, the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, and the Veterans Voices Writing Project. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.